Vastamai, good afternoon and welcome to this week's episode of Perspective. I'm Dolan Mercer here with you until 2 o'clock, along with producer Aaron Ibanez and our studio guests. On the programme this week, in The Guardian, ecological restoration can be a powerful means of protecting the atmosphere. We need to rewild on a massive scale. William Hague wrote in The Telegraph, "The time for denial is over. Conservatives have to take the climate crisis seriously." And a letter to the editor of The Times said the conclusion of the Committee on Climate Change is that, among other actions, the UK will need to plant almost 3 billion trees to become carbon neutral by 2050. A global report commissioned by the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, or IBPES for short, is being released tomorrow. And closer to home, next week is Manx Wildlife Week, run by Manx National Heritage. So, today and next Sunday, the Perspective team are looking to explore the ecological crisis now facing the Isle of Man, the British Isles, and planet Earth in 2019. On Sunday the 12th, we'll discuss how policymakers should tackle the issue with the Minister of Environment, Food and Agriculture, representatives of the Climate Change Coalition on the island, and some student activists too. But ahead of that discussion, today we're going to look at man and the wild, the natural environment of the Isle of Man and all of its residents. I'm joined in the studio by Tim Graham, who's Chief Executive Officer at the Manx Wildlife Trust. Also joining us, Neil Morris of Manx BirdLife and Dr. Richard Selman, who's Ecosystem Policy Manager at the Department of Environment, Food and Agriculture, and is also formerly Government's Senior Biodiversity Officer. To begin with on this week, I would quite like to have a look at the current sort of ecological landscape of the Isle of Man and talk a bit about what we can see at the minute. How does the island, first of all, maybe compare in ecological terms with other jurisdictions, maybe, as a point of starters? Tim, if I could come to you.
Yeah, okay. Well, in a sort of snapshot to kick that off, I guess, as an island, where we've got a confined space, but we've probably got examples of most of the major sort of habitats and ecosystems from the British Isles, really. Just confined space that operates on it. And obviously there's also the fact that we're an island and the ecology of that evolution sort of influenced what species were naturally here, what have come in and things, and how that kind of works in terms of what's perhaps highly sensitive to kind of environmental changes or our actions as well. So the most noticeable thing is sort of marine coast and the hills, you know, the first things that anybody coming to the island will really notice. We've got quite specialist marine environments surrounding the island, so the mail beds and things stand out for me, knowing that, you know, people talk about the British Isles, they're kind of rare around the British Isles, and we've got a good amount, basically, especially, you know, for a limited area. We've got the uplands that stand out, we've got the heath moorland, we've got the bog and things like that. And then that's all about kind of what management. There's a lot of views that starts airing towards more controversial ecological territory and things, but that also hits the climate change side of things big time with peat and things, really interesting for particular species and things, and obviously starts linking in with things that stand out for the island that Neil will be better to talk about, like hen harriers and things, that, you know, it does stand out as a population for the Isle of Man, definitely.
And so on an island community then, from a professional point of view, does that provide particular challenges, or does that make work easier perhaps for people who are trying to monitor ecosystems?
Well, it's a huge opportunity living here because everything's so accessible. You can be on a beautiful rocky coast walk 1 minute, half an hour later you could be up on the hills. So the accessibility is a massive boon to living here. So, I mean, that's beautiful for everybody to be able to enjoy all those environments fairly easily. And I think a lot of people particularly appreciate that quality of life aspect of living here and settling here with their business. So from a biosphere perspective, it's definitely a boon.
And does that change maybe the pressures on whether that be the Department of Environment, Food and Agriculture or third parties in their work? Do they undertake work in different ways maybe here than perhaps equivalent people might do overseas?
I think that we have similar kinds of habitats to other British Isles jurisdictions and therefore similar issues and needs. Obviously, we have differences between jurisdictions in our particular situations, both legislatively, resources and such like. And so we have to cut to fit as suits our particular needs. And we all tend to exchange experiences and we'll have very valuable liaison meetings through a number of different organisations, such as British Irish Council, the Channel Island organise annual environment meetings. And so these kinds of meetings are really useful to exchange our knowledge in doing things a little bit differently. People have new ideas and describe what they've been doing, and we all learn from that.
With respect to the organisations on the Isle of Man, what kinds of work is done maybe between different people, whether that be yourselves or other organisations, as things stand?
So thinking about how we're kind of actually managing to deliver in this area and stuff, I guess in a lot of ways it's similar, but with the kind of resource constraint, certain things operate slightly differently, be it through policies and things. You know, we've got the agricultural changes that might be coming in this year, etc. That is our national choice here on the Isle of Man, basically, so that operates differently. We've got ourselves sitting in the room that operate similar, basically, to, you know, equivalent organisations elsewhere in the British Isles, and we work together, hopefully, always do more, but in similar ways. You know, there's areas of expertise. Certainly, we can't kind of get, perhaps, as much expertise as easily drawn together just from the island necessarily, just through the fact that there's so much across the British Isles, and then they just say all meet in London, etc., and it becomes slightly different sometimes. So there's some areas sometimes that there might be gaps in expertise for the island, and so that can sometimes change the work. But in some ways we've got ways that are closer connected, perhaps, so it's easier if we choose to perhaps get action undertaken. You know, certainly you'd think of perhaps politicians as being easier, more easily accessible, mm-hmm. and things, rather than in different parts of the country, or even thought of as not part of their own country, if you thought about how the UK's sort of operating and things. So definitely advantages. We've got partnership projects with DEFA in various ways. So thinking things that have been going on for a long time, a number of years, in terms of wildflowers and working on endangered plant species, bringing them back, Wildflowers of Man and Ramsey Forest work up in the north of the island and stuff like that. I mean, there's a lot of examples, but probably we'd all agree that there could be more joined up partnership working, and so better working together in various areas.
Yeah, we recognise there are some some really significant pockets of expertise around the island. Botanical expertise, zoology, for example, fungi as well. We mustn't forget fungi, the smaller organisms. Probably what we lack is the NGO infrastructure that brings us all together as a common voice. And I think with some of the bigger issues, it's now increasingly important that the charitable organisations, the non-governmental organisations that have these pockets of expertise, pool their efforts, because there are some really quite significant challenges ahead, and none of us can do it alone.
To stick with you, if I may, I'm talking sort of on behalf of a smaller third party, if it were. How at the minute do you sort of get your voice heard, I suppose?
Well, it's really interesting, and it takes me back to my early days at RSPB, where you recognise there are issues and subjects which very much catch the public attention, but they're not always the important issues. And so I think the balance is always, for a small organisation, to find the subjects that help you connect with your audience, that help you connect with influences, that allow you to have a voice, and use those opportunities to then start talking about the other, perhaps more important issues. You know, there's a lot of talk about climate change, and we're not going to expand on that too much today. But it has certainly caught the public imagination now. But actually, climate change is just a part of the issue. but it's the one that's caught everyone's attention. So it's a case of using climate change and the interest now that that brings on the environment to talk about other more fundamental and systemic issues in food chains and in ecology and in species and habitats on the island and, of course, elsewhere around the world.
So if, just building upon that, perhaps if I could ask, it's a fairly open question, really, what kinds of pressures are facing the Manx ecosystem, if you like, at the minute, sort of bigger than just climate change, but maybe some other pressures?
Well, in a word, people. It all starts, and hopefully it will all end, with people. Nature does what nature does. Nature's very good at filling niches and spotting opportunities, and then through natural selection, organisms fill a niche. And the human species has become dominant. And so when we look at a lot of the issues that are causing problems on the island and elsewhere, the root cause is always people, people's activities, behaviours, attitudes, consumption, etc. And a lot of that is where we live our lives and inadvertently we have an impact on our environment without realising it. And I think a lot of the answer is about education. And we must put huge efforts into informing people so that they can change what they do and they can understand how they have a role to play in helping to put things back to where they need to be.
So what kinds of education kind of takes place at the minute in terms of working with the public to be informative about these issues?
That's an interesting one. There's probably a number of different levels kind of going on. One's an example, you know, we work with DEFA in terms of schools work and things, and there's a level, and that, but in a way, they're probably, one, they're, you know, they're ready as sponges, but also they're quite well informed in terms of young audiences understand the importance in the environment and things, and are probably the most likely to be able to change and things. And, you know, we're seeing that through the effects of the kind of youth protests and things like that. But then the kind of longer ball game and more difficult work is that kind of broader engagement that's kind of usually ends up with you're informing, but how do you make sure there is a sort of suitable behaviour change, say, things like that? That's long-term choices. You know, we know that it reflects on people's everyday lives and things like that. You know, they're used to doing something. Say it could be something as simple as, well, are dogs under control and things? Are they disturbing breeding birds and things? How many people are all going? Everybody's thinking about, oh, I'm going down, but that's all that's going on. And then somebody's got to look at it and they're seeing, well, actually, there's hundreds of people going down, and that's a lot that each individual doesn't really see in terms of a disturbance. So that makes it much more complex. But to kind of educate becomes quite formal and sounds like you're telling them exactly what to do. But what works is helping them understand, and in another way, it's got to be usually quite clever and not too kind of confrontational in many ways. And then encouraging that slight behavioural change. Sometimes it needs something stricter. It might be that important, but the big long-term game is somehow informing and really engaging them so they're understanding and it changes. The other advantage is if you can see that something might happen, is getting in there before that kind of cultural practice has really set in, because it's so hard to change, you know, and it might not. But you might be able to lessen impact or be able to think ways around it that help sort of mitigate it a bit. And there's sort of examples of projects going on all the time around that, really, across Ireland, and the organisations are really sort of really getting stuck in. And I think about our staff in various ways. If really there's lots of different routes to that, whether it's bits of consultancy work and working with clients, or whether it's actually kind of working with the public, commissioners, various things that actually, you know, it could seem quite simple about how a site's used, or guided walks and informing people about the fact that something's having an impact on site and then taking that away and understanding it that bit more. There's a lot of levels to try and program in, and for us as organisations to resource and keep being there, to keep informing and perhaps coordinating messages in certain areas and things as well.
What's really interesting is that young people get it instinctively. They know, and of course we've had Greta Thunberg, who's a very smart young lady, and she's able to articulate what a lot of young people feel, but possibly at that age don't have the skills to communicate. And what you find is that young people understand nature. Once you surgically remove them from their devices, put them out in the countryside, they get it, they know it, what it's about, and they understand what long-term futures are about as well. And that's quite a surprising thing when you talk to young people, and they're looking 500 years ahead as to what the state of the environment is going to be. But then what happens is that society, as they grow up, does everything it can to remove them from their environment, whether it's through education, whether it's through living in urbanisations. And I think it's when people, we were talking about this earlier, when you have your own children, you sort of then come back again to realise that you need to think about the world from their eyes, not your own eyes. And I have a very good friend who I often quote, who had nothing to do with the environment in his teens and his early 20s. But once he had his own children, he started to see it through their eyes, got very interested in the natural world, and became a fantastic communicator and advocate to his own children. And hopefully that's how, from generation to generation, you get this growing interest.
Just to kind of move slightly to a different angle, I suppose, from perceptions of the natural environment and engagement with the natural environment to perhaps its health. How are we looking on the Isle of Man and further afield at the minute in terms of the health of the natural environment? Maybe that might be one for you, Richard.
I expect that although we don't have lots of formal monitoring programs on the Isle of Man, I think it's fair to assume that the changes that are occurring here are pretty similar, bearing in mind the similarity of habitats to what's happening, say, in the UK. And in the UK, there are some studies which show some very significant changes. For instance, there's very long-term moth recording, which has shown changes in not only rare species declining, but many of the very common species declining as well. So we are seeing fewer moths and fewer species of moths in particular sampling. And it's not just moths that are affected, but there are certain areas of the insect world which seem to be affected more than others. So moths, dung beetles, a lot of aquatic species like mayflies and caddisflies. These have definitely seen quite large-scale declines, and that is definitely a worry. And the more science that's done on that, the more it seems to back up that there is a definite effect there, which is due to a number of different things. Touching back on what we've just been talking about, is not going too awry off the line there. The health of the ecology affects our own health as well. So we're talking about engagement and people's access to nature, to be able to engage and have local green space that they can go and utilise. We now know from studies in human health that the getting fresh air, getting sunshine, getting physical activity and getting contact with the wonder of nature itself all have very lasting benefits on mental health, and that's something that's quite a hot topic at the moment. So I think it's very, very important that we maintain access to very local green space, not too far from everybody's houses, as we urbanise more and more, which we are, even though we're a small island. Half the population lives in Douglas, and I'm always surprised to hear how many people actually don't even seem to go out of Douglas on their days off. So although I love to be out in the countryside, I recognise there are other people who live in a slightly different microculture. They're interested in other things, which is fine, but I wouldn't like to think that they're being disadvantaged in some way by not being engaged with something which might help.
Coming back partly to the point about people and the impact that humans have on the natural environment around us, are there concerns perhaps about man's meddling a bit in the ecosystem in which we live?
Well, we could do a whole program on that. We have got ourselves into a situation where man has meddled so much in the natural world that two things happen. to try to get back to some sense of stability with the natural world, we have to continue meddling. We have to sort of unmeddle, if you like. But in terms of nature conservation, it has been very successful in many ways over the last 50 years. But if you look at the big picture, you know, we need nature conservation to up its own game in the future. And you have to ask yourself, does that therefore mean we need to meddle even more? And I think the future is about not meddling. It's about letting nature take its course. But to do that, you have to give over large landscapes to nature to allow it to do that, and accept the fact that things like floods, fires, are a natural part of succession in the ecosystem. But of course, where things like fires and floods cause problems to people, that is a real issue. So you have to find a way to let nature do its thing that's compatible with the sort of society that we would like to have. So yes, there's a lot more work for us to do, but I think it's about trying to unpick our involvement and our interference in the natural environment. And if you look at the island, as Richard said, it's no different to anywhere else. We have the same problems, but islands do offer particular challenges because they have smaller ecosystems, and that makes them somewhat more vulnerable to change and to impacts. And, you know, I love the island. I think it's a wonderful place. It's got some wonderful landscapes. But if you do scratch the surface and you look at the organisms that occupy that landscape, you start to see the problems. So we have got some work to do to start getting back to where I think we should be. But that's in order to get to a point where we stop interfering as much.
One form that man's meddling has taken is through the sort of overriding of natural processes in terms of invasive species and introducing species to environments they might not normally have been exposed to. I was wondering if that's something we could talk about a bit in this part of the programme. Have we seen many examples of that taking place on the Isle of Man?
Yeah, so in terms of thinking about, the first things to highlight is, you know, there's a number of non-native species on island, and then it's about where they cross a threshold in terms of becoming invasive. There's got to be some form of harm.
So where's that distinction drawn? That'd probably be a good one to
That gets quite difficult. So harm could be something economic that starts to define that, or it can be ecological. But you could imagine what kind of level of information that might require to actually show it. It might be easy. So if you took an example across, understanding whether a mink is invasive was, although there was still a lot of resource required to put the facts together, it was quite clear that they were invading ecosystems. They were starting to have massive impacts, not just on waterfalls, but also any ground nesting birds, fish species. You know, they can eat a lot if you ever find how many carcasses are near mink and things. So, you know, some things can stand out like that, other things can be much harder, and it starts erring into kind of more belief, things like that. But in some ways, the observations start there anyway. So we've got things that are mentioned in our Wildlife Act in terms of legal constraints for people to think about. So, you know, one that becomes obvious in the countryside might be Montbretia, that's mentioned on Scheduled 8 and things. So, you know, being careful about spread, but it's a difficult one. It's kind of in large clusters and things. And then, you know, you've got the work on the biosecurity that I know DEFRA's been taken forward, that's got to think about quite strictly, and the marine environment, what comes into marinas, educating, things like that, getting in before, because that's the big thing. We mentioned it, it's a lot easier if you're getting in before an issue than, you know, the cost and resource required once something's really kicked in. So there's that side of it. There's a number of questions about what's sort of native in terms of plant species and how they arrived and things like that, because, you know, we have been doing various levels of meddling for a long time. You know, we bring crops, poppies came with them, various things like that. You know, rabbits. The other one is an obvious one with a massive impact, rats. And we know that how much effort needs to be put in to be able to eradicate them and to try and keep that stable. And, you know, the big impact, seeing positive return of Manxies. But, you know, how long for? It's still not a consistent eradication. It requires a lot of effort constantly on the calf of man. So, you know, it shows you what level of impact that the population can be so devastated that gave the bird the name. Shows you what invasive species can do, basically.
And just a quick apology to perhaps the more superstitious Manx listeners. If I could come to you, Richard, what sort of defines a non-native species becoming invasive? And do we have perpetrators of that on the island?
Yeah, I mean, clearly there are lots of species which we wouldn't define as native to the Isle of Man that have found their own way here naturally of their own accord without the aid of man in some way. But they're not all invasive. So what does invasiveness mean? To put it in very simple terms for me, I guess I would say it is damaging in some way to man's interests. Might be broad interests, ecological, could be social, economic. Has it the capacity to spread? Because there are lots of species we have in our gardens that we don't greatly worry about because they're not likely to jump the hedge and then spread across the fields rapidly. If it does spread, is it easy to control? So the problematic species we're looking at are the ones that are damaging, they spread rapidly, and they're very hard to control. So things like Japanese knotweed spring to mind immediately because it's very hard to get rid of once it's out there. So you don't want to let it out there in the first place. So there's quite a few like that. Crassula is a terrible one. It's even in one of our reservoirs now, so maybe somebody dumped some in it or in a ditch above it or probably some garden detritus they threw out. Pond plants in general can be a problem, hence the Bee Plant-Wise campaign that there is about care in dealing with these things, what you put in your pond and definitely what you do with that afterwards. And crassula is one of those plants that once you put it out in a natural pond somewhere, it's almost impossible to remove because you only need tiny, tiny little bits of it to reform. So you can take 99.99999% of it and leave one tiny little bit. Next year it's back to square one where you were before. So these are the major plants. So there's a list of the 100 worst in the world, which is worth keeping an eye on. And some species have a form of ecological release. So there might be a problem in one area, not in another. So you take them out of their normal ecological context, where they're in a balance, put them somewhere else with a different set of species, they become a problem. You might have removed them from their natural predators or pathogens. And that can be very, very difficult to predict. And on islands, we're very sensitive to those concerns because each island has a different biota, a different set of species. And it is quite hard to predict if you bring in another species, how that'll fit into the balance, what other species it'll affect in the process. Other species, because of their inherent invasive characteristics and tendencies, you could take to all sorts of places in the world and they would probably be a problem in the kinds of habitats that man tends to produce, those kinds of open habitats, edge habitats, hedgerows and such like gardens. And those are the ones that get onto the 100 worst miscreants that we can think of in human terms. Obviously, nature is nature. This is it's very much a human perspective, what is invasive, human-centric thing, absolutely.
I'm interested that I ask about invasive species, and lots of the things you spoke about there were to do with plants or flora and fauna, whatever the kind of the category you might choose. But perhaps a more immediate one to think about on the Isle of Man would be wallabies, which I certainly would imagine is non-native.
It is that.
Neil, maybe one for you. I believe there's a bit of a conflict with hen harriers on the island.
I tend to take quite a fundamental starting stance when it comes to non-native species. We do have this parlance about non-native and invasive, and as Richard describes, invasive is when we can label something as known to be damaging and known to be difficult to control. And that's often at the extreme end of things. But I think when we think about the island and we're saying how special the island is and how fragile its ecology is. And that ecology has developed over thousands of years. So translocating Antipodean marsupial rodents to the island is a bit like possibly the danger of transporting flu to the Americas. And it can have no effect at all. It can have terrible effects, or the ecosystem can gradually accommodate to the new species that it's got. Now, if you look at wallabies in particular, we're talking from quite a low base of evidence, because no one has ever stamped up the money to do some proper studies into the juxtaposition of wallabies and the Manx native fauna and flora. And that's probably needed. But also, why should we bother with that? Because they just don't belong here. There is no way they would have got here naturally. They don't enhance the environment of the Isle of Man. They're a bit of a novelty, and they've got a bit of fur, and they've got a couple of big round eyes, and some people seem to think that's enough to justify they should be here. But when you start to look a bit deeper, if you go to places like the Curraghs, where there is a dense population of wallabies, and you look at the impact they're having on the ground, and then you put yourself in the mindset of some of our native creatures, the hen harriers you mentioned being a good example, could you as a hen harrier continue to live in some of these places with wallabies? And I think the evidence at the moment is no. And the Curraghs, we have to remember, is our only Ramsar designated wetland. That's an international convention of designation for important wetlands around the world. And it was designated on the basis of having, amongst other things, Europe's largest winter roost of hen harriers. Now, can you imagine what a magnificent sight anywhere between 100 and 160 winter roosting hen harriers coming into roost in an area of the Curraghs would have been? And what an economic opportunity that would have been, because we could have said to the whole of the rest of Europe, we've got the biggest roosting group of hen harriers. It's a fantastic spectacle. Come on over here and have a look at it. But we think, due in part or due largely to the issue of wallabies, there are now no roosting hen harriers in the Curraghs. We've lost them. We've lost that spectacle. We've lost that economic opportunity. And worst of all, the Curraghs have degraded quite significantly since that original citation. We've lost the nesting corncrakes, for example. We have lost a huge number of breeding birds in there. We've lost quite a lot of the wetland ground nesting birds. And a management plan that is implemented is desperately needed for the Curraghs, but there's no point coming up with a very clever management plan for our Ramsar wetland that is the Curraghs, unless first of all you remove some of the factors that will mitigate against success. So I think, considering all of that, wallabies for me are a huge problem. They don't belong here, and it's an issue we need to address.
Are those results a direct sort of consequence of the introduction of wallabies, or is there reason to believe that?
There is strong reason to believe it. Unfortunately, I don't think we have the empirical evidence that we can put on the table. But these days, conservation is as much about being precautious. There is a thing called the precautionary principle. And I think we have to get serious about what is important to the island in terms of our wildlife. And I would have thought native Manx wildlife should be top of that list. That's the most important thing for us to look after. And if we have any sense that a non-native species that has been introduced by us, that would never have found its way here naturally, is causing a problem, we need to get on top of it. So we absolutely prioritise Manx native fauna and flora first and foremost.
If I could bring Richard and Tim in, are they sentiments you would agree with?
I guess I'd say in part, I definitely agree. We've got to have the management plan, I think, is huge, and it should be landscape scale. And some of the work we've done recently, and thinking back to the fact that the Curraghs rocks as designated as a small fraction of what used to be there, even in 1982 development plan and things. So we know that at least a third's gone and been improved, etc. But in some ways that also shows perhaps where some of the success of the designation has it. That's not considering that area, really. That area's managed to be held on to in some respect. But obviously we've just talked about declines. The botanists would talk about floral declines and things as well. You'd talk about health and condition, perhaps, in many ways. But I think it'd be very difficult to disentangle what the kind of approach to management in the wider area has been and what sort of started to succeed into denser willow curragh, etc., that would, in effect, change the environment for nesting hen harriers. But I don't think that even if you tried to restore it, that the wallaby population would enable you to get back to what was there in the early 2000s or anything, because it would just be a different state of that kind of environment and habitat, really. To add something about known evidence of impacts of wallabies, I would say, as they fully interfere with our management plans on our nature reserves, that there is a definite conflict with the interest of Manx Wildlife Trust there. So, you know, that doesn't need any further evidence. We know that they wipe out our coppice, etc., in the woodlands. We are starting to think that as an option within our management, natural regeneration, thinking about that kind of power of allowing nature to do its thing, isn't possible because of the wallaby impact. And the way I'd sort of describe it is a bit like many people, especially the Scottish, understand what deer populations can do. So we don't have some of our sort of what would have been native grazers from the past, etc., that would have provided some impact. But actually, you know, high densities of deer can go the other way, and you see that a lot in Scotland. So if you thought about the wallabies in whatever way, you hear a lot of stories, you know they're providing some grazing, etc., in that niche. Well, yes, but in density it goes completely the other way. And you know, it's the fact that there's been no action, accountability. We're not getting to grips with the management of that landscape at all. And it should be an exemplar. And as Neil said, you know, the whole rationale behind Close Sartfield, our flagship site, at its start was the orchids and things and the display that they give that was internationally renowned. And then the fact that Off the Hide, that has a specially built platform on the top, was to view that. That actual hen harry roost, which you can't do, and people did used to come and visit the island to actually see that spectacle. So that's definitely true, and I think that would be, you know, it's hard to give words to actually what that would do, especially when you talk about the story of hen harriers across the British Isles. We should be singing from the rooftops currently, but then there's probably more that we could be doing.
Just to come back to something that Neil said, and you've mentioned it as well, it's provided some use, I guess you could say, in terms of being a bit of a gimmick and being a bit of a tourist draw, the wallabies, and we've seen coverage on BBC Northwest Tonight, and you know,
and it provides an experience. I've got to admit that as well. You know, it engages people and it engages an audience in many ways that, you know, aren't our kind of usual warm audience. And we have kind of conflicts within the organization thinking about that. You know, we have a lot of people turning up just wanting to see wallabies and things. We do wallaby walks, but we do try and explain about what kind of impacts we're seeing, and that level of kind of information, informing people, educating them, things on some of that, because it needs to be said that there are, okay, it's not brilliant evidence, but there's definitely impacts starting to come through whichever way. And the other side of it is that they do engage people, unfortunately. They definitely do. And I was recently on site with the conservation manager of Plant Life, the UK, and she was still gobsmacked that, you know, that there's wallabies breeding in the area, kind of thing. It is a strange conversation to be having, to be honest.
Yeah. Just finally, I think we could probably do a whole programme on wallabies, actually, but would kind of DEFA's official view be in line perhaps with two people we've heard from already?
Certainly I remember seeing the enormous numbers of hen harriers when I was here in the early 2000s, And it was a real spectacle and very unusual to see that. And there's no doubting that they've gone in terms of that large winter roost. Now, we don't know exactly why that is. Disturbance, we know, can be a very significant factor for hen harriers. So it is a significant likelihood that some form of disturbance has resulted. We had a student in about 2006, 2008 that did the first assessment of the numbers of wallabies when we thought there were about 100 and had a bit of a look at diet and scats. And the thinking at the time was that they weren't seeming to have a very significant effect on the habitat, but also noting that we're lacking natural grazing browsers because we no longer have red deer, the bones that have been dug up. And the likelihood of bringing them back is perhaps low with all the motorsport on the island and people who have other interests in these things. Roe deer as well, I believe, is in the archaeological record. So we have that juxtaposition of we've got a wetland site which is naturally becoming more wooded. There have been control measures to reduce that to some extent, but it seems to grow faster than it can be cut down. Some of that is very valuable, particularly where you've got mature stuff which has very interesting lichens and insects related to it. So we don't want to remove the woodland either because that's important, but it's finding a balance between the different levels. I think in terms of the birds that were mentioned, the next step is really to assess what the change has been because we have some quite good bird data, so we can look into what the data actually says about that. But how we manage the balance between the different areas of different kinds of habitats and what is the appropriate management is a challenge, and a management plan across the whole site rather than individual sites as we do currently would be useful to look at that. My personal view is that wetting could have a significant effect because there's quite a lot of drains through there. Now we're always going to need some of the key drains to drain outside of the site because of the interests of agriculturalists and such like out around the edges of the site. But that doesn't mean you have to drain the site itself right through it as a network. And the wetter it is, the better it is for wildlife from my perspective. And the drier it is, the more you're going to encourage that movement to woodland that would naturally take place through natural change and drying itself. So there were some key challenges in there and we haven't resolved them yet. The wallabies might well be an issue and more could be done to see whether it actually is an issue. So we'll see.
I know I said just finally before, it turns out that was a lie. I've got another question. we've spoken a lot about the health of other species which have been affected by the wallabies. How about the health of the wallabies themselves? Is it in their interests to be there?
That's an interesting question. I know we get a lot of report from the volunteers that are out in the area all the time. Now, I've not personally seen one for a while in terms of looking unhealthy and sort of almost clouded eyes, things like that. A bit, the way we describe it is a bit like myxomatosis in rabbits and things. I've not personally seen it, but we get a lot of reports, and this is what, you know, the public report as well. So whether there's a sort of animal welfare issue out there as well in terms of it not being a healthy population, what you'd kind of expect in a small restricted population is that inbreeding kind of brings these kind of health problems out because they are they're bred from very limited numbers in effect from collection. So yeah, you'd kind of expect that. The exact facts on that I don't know, just because we haven't really pulled together numbers. Certainly reported a lot, and then perhaps cyclically as well, so that when I first came into position about 3 years ago, it didn't seem to be as reported, and it's certainly over the last year, it seemed to be reported to us via our volunteers on sites and the public a bit more, but I don't have any hard, fast facts, really.
Whenever I've looked at them, there seem to have been quite a lot of blind ones around. It could be caused by various different things. Toxicara, there are various different infections could be causing it. There could be a dietary element to it, being in a very acidic habitat there, in terms of minerals, but we don't actually know what the cause is. But it is an issue. But when people say, well, perhaps you should cull them for their own welfare, That just doesn't stack up logically to me. It's not in a welfare to kill an animal for its own benefit, is it? As an individual, but yeah, so it's a wild population. It has issues that wild populations have. It's probably different here to elsewhere, but we know that wallabies are particularly susceptible to Toxocara as one particular thing, I believe. Elsewhere where there are non-native populations of the same species, and there are quite a few in the British Isles, North America, various places, there are little populations of these, and Toxocara can be more of a problem for them than many other mammals because they seem to be much more greatly affected. And I don't know why that is in the wallabies, but it seems to be quite devastating for them, whereas for other species it's less so.
This sort of half of the programme, we're going to expand discussion a bit more. Earlier this week, one of the Manx Radio team went down to the Manx Museum to Natural History Gallery, among the displays of the island's plant and wildlife, and spoke to the curator of natural history there, Laura McCoy, to get her views on the health of the living world and man's relationship with it. Aaron Ibanez had this opening question.
Are we at a pretty crucial point, do you think, right now on the human timeline?
I think so, yes. I think there are signs, when you start to look and measure things that are happening in the natural world, there are a lot of critical tipping points, and that I think if we hit them, we will start to see mass change, which we will struggle to cope with. And things are happening very quickly, and I think we have to react quickly. But that is often, you know, seen as difficult, especially by governments and people that have a lot of stuff to deal with. They go, oh God, you know, how can we do this in this short amount of time? Is there the political will to do this in the shortest amount of time? I think that nature will force our hand when stuff starts to break down.
And these notions of a climate breakdown and indeed an ecological sort of emergency, it's very difficult for people to tangibly grasp that, I guess. So in one aspect, it's truly valuable to be out in nature and perhaps start recognising what we have and understanding the sort of fine balance, as you referred to there, and the lack of symbiosis maybe at the moment.
Mm. Well, I would say that we're not really symbiotic anymore, we're parasitic. For instance, the Wildlife Trust recently did a really great exhibition, and one of the key things in that exhibition was talking about shifting baselines of what we think of as normal in the environment. So if you talk to somebody that's 80 years old and they talk about, even in their lifetime, the abundance in the natural world and what they would see, you know, flocks of linnets, or, you know, loads of insects and bees, and, you know, just everything was just humming and buzzing and singing, and there was just so much more in the countryside. You know, driving down roads and seeing beautiful swathes of wildflowers in the margins and hedgerows full of sparrows and, you know, all of this stuff, you know, they saw that was their normal. And yet when we drive down very tidy country roads, all we see is threshed hedgerows that are cut back to, you know, beyond recognition. They aren't really even a functioning hedge anymore. Very lovely amenity grass next to roads, roadside verges, but we think, you know, people that are young think that's normal.
Yeah, and that conditioning, I suppose, that people are being brought up with is that the tidy countryside is the countryside in all its glory, and that is the natural world, and the natural world is a sort of patchwork of grassland split by hedgerows, and perhaps it's not as nature intended.
Well, I mean, we have to, you know, live within the landscape, and I think it would be difficult, you know, I don't think it's feasible or right to just say, oh no, well then we just have to not touch it, because of course we have to grow our food and we have to, you know, function as a society. But I think that there are spaces that could be left to be more natural, or at least not put under such intense pressure. So, you know, leave those hedgerows to become more full and don't thresh them and cut them every year, cut them every 3 or 5 years, or don't mow everything to the nth degree every 5 minutes. You can leave it, and actually it's less work for you to do. A lot of these things actually require less work, so not spraying things, not collecting cut grass, not having to mow everything every 5 minutes, not having to cut hedges every year. It would be a lot cheaper as well to not have to do actively just mess with things all the time.
That was Manx National Heritage Curator of Natural History, Laura McCoy, there speaking to Aaron Ibanez earlier this week. Lots of points to talk about, I think, in there. One that caught my ear, the idea that nature will provide the urgency, almost. What would your thoughts be on that, Tim?
Well, that's certainly the increasing message that's coming out, and obviously people will be aware from the press and obviously Extinction Rebellion and getting in everyone's faces there. And it's becoming an increasing kind of reality and facts that it's hard to conceive in the kind of long term that we're sometimes talking about, but it's realistic that we feel it. Especially if you think about primary school children now are going to be seeing in the 21st century and things. So, you know, they're going to really feel and have to make difficult choices if it carries on. And, you know, you hear facts about soil, often, you know, UK-based facts. But if you take the fact that, you know, some of it's going to be realistic for us to at least consider and be able to say whether that's applicable to Ireland and things, which might be an effort in itself. But you think about, you know, the loss of fertility in topsoil, things like that all come from these kind of modifications of the natural system that we're losing that fertility and things. And then we've been talking about well-being and how that impacts on our health and things. We know it has a massive impact on air quality and all kinds of things, that it starts to coordinate, you know, water management, flooding, all these things, as well as carbon release from things like peatlands and things, are all going to exacerbate. Whether there's a real vision of a tipping point, etc., it's quite hard to conceive, but it's certainly becoming a massive discussion point. We're going to have new international targets to try and hit for 2030. And there's a global deal for nature that's starting to come out that's been talked about recently over the last couple of weeks. And because of the seriousness of this, that they're talking about the fact that we've got to save 30% of the earth at least for nature, and another 20% that's going to be nature-based solutions linked to climate change. And that's still just as realistic for us to be contributing and looking at what's realistic. And also just thinking about what's going to make sure that our ecosystems continue to function for us in the way that they should. We are sensitive as an island state. We've talked about that, the fact that we can feel these impacts easier. So the best route is to make sure things are in the healthiest state they can be. And then we've got the kind of policies that support that as well.
Seems a good opportunity to throw ahead to next week's programme on Perspective, Sunday the 12th of May. We will be speaking in more depth about some of the maybe political discussions around climate change. Another point made in that interview there was that man has become, has ceased to be symbiotic in its relationship with the natural environment and is now parasitic. Throws back a bit to some of the discussions we were having, Neil, in the first half about the influence of man on the environment in which we reside.
Yes, and we shouldn't stand aside and say we're not a part of that natural environment. You know, we are but one organism within the whole ecosystem. And there are so many indicators out there. Laura mentioned the word tipping point as well. And if you've read James Lovelock's book, Gaia, which really expresses Earth's systems as an equilibrium. And if you've done your chemistry at school, you will know that if you have chemicals in balance, you can push that balance so far and it will bounce back and it will restore the balance. Push it too far beyond that tipping point and there is no return. And I think what is worrying a lot of scientists at the moment is that man's impact on the planet is now getting so significant, and it is accelerating, where that tipping point, it's not unrealistic to think that we might be closing in on that tipping point, where actually the warming of the seas, the melting of the ice caps, the destruction of the rainforests, etc., etc., is getting to the point of no return. And if you look at all the indicators around us, we would be foolish to ignore them. And of course, politics is an instrument of human society. Politics really is a way of doing things the best way possible for as many people as possible. And so we have to remember that politics is really a servant of society's need. And so it's important that we as non-governmental organisations do our best to furnish politicians with the evidence, with the indicators that help them to make the right decisions and show the right leadership on behalf of our society. Did you know that for every human on the planet, there are 200 million insects? And so in terms of our place in that ecosystem, within the food chain on planet Earth, we need 200 million insects, each person, in order for the ecology of the planet to actually work. That's astounding. And so when we're looking at some of the figures for insect loss, and the headline one is that we're losing 2.5% of our biomass or volume of insects across the planet every year. So in 10 years, we will have lost a quarter of those 200 million insects that we each need to forage, to remove the detritus, to provide all the services they provide as part of the ecosystem. And bringing this more closely to home, over the last year and a half, Manx BirdLife has been conducting a seabird census. And some of the headline figures there are quite interesting. We've maybe lost two or three breeding species from the island over 200 or 300 years. And as someone observed to me, well, that's not bad, is it? Personally, I think the loss of anything is a tragedy, particularly from a small island nation such as this. But the figure for me that really stands out from our research is that over the last 20 years, we've lost 53% of our seabird biomass. And if you think that seabirds are towards the very top of the food chain of our marine system, that is telling us that our marine system now can only support half the number of organisms that it used to. And I find that quite scary.
If you don't mind me fairly heavy-handedly dropping a crude point in at this time, you've mentioned a bit about the motorsport influence on the Isle of Man. You hear racers say, and I've heard it said, that in their racing careers, they've seen a dramatic decrease in the amount of insects splattered on their visors. Oh, yeah. Now, this is a point that, you know, very different listenerships will have heard about. Are there concerns, Richard, maybe one for you, about decreases in the health of whatever species it might be on the Isle of Man more recently?
Yes, I mean, somebody has termed what we're living in as the Anthropocene, because there's no doubting that man has the prime effect on the planet now. And a recent paper noted that we expect there to be potentially extinction of 40% of the world's insect species over the next few decades. Now, shortly we should be hearing from a consensus of the world's experts on biodiversity, on wildlife, on what's likely to happen, because there's an intergovernmental panel, as there has been on climate change, which was very influential on taking forward a public view and engagement and thereby policy and politicians on what is happening and therefore what should occur to take account of that. Hopefully the report that will come out from the Intergovernmental Panel on Biodiversity may be able to engage the public in a similar manner to actually understand what the issues are realistically with the facts from around the world. And there's no doubting that we're subject to these changes as much as anybody else, but it's obviously different in the tropics to what it is here, different species affected. Yes, there are big changes happening, and we should definitely take account of that.
Tim has mentioned some of the protests in London we've seen over the past fortnight from Extinction Rebellion, kind of under the banner that we're facing, or we're in the midst of, a bit of an ecological crisis. Do you feel as though that's a sensationalised kind of viewpoint, or, I mean, it would appear that the evidence suggests that's quite accurate?
Yeah, I think the evidence does. Neil's done some evidence close to home. We've got the wider insect. We know that 25% of the plants on island from the flora that the Wildlife Trust work on are at risk, major risk, and things as well. Certainly, if you talk to the entomologists, then they're concerned heavily about the abundance and biomass of invertebrates, not just what species are where and things. So, although it's very hard and time-consuming and obviously costs money to really get concrete data, it certainly seems to be supported that it is, and that we're feeling some level of it as well. So the kind of action that we need to be thinking about is how we give that space to functioning nature that it's allowed to recover. I know we mentioned the campaign Wilder Future that we've had an exhibition on, and that's very much thinking about how this is quite a complex situation. We've got certain actions that we've been used to taking. We've got to kind of scale that up. This is where, you know, all the conversation about rewilding and things starts coming in, giving the ecology and its processes a chance at scale to really operate so that we can get our kind of abundances and viable populations back within the ecosystems they need to be part of. But then you've got, obviously, we've got decisions to make in terms of what a much wider impacts from sustainability and our choices and things like that. So it's not necessarily easy. And that's why I think it's perfectly adequate to call it a crisis as well, because the kind of interventions that are needed, it's a difficult decision now. You've got to imagine what kind of level of difficulty that's going to be in another decade or another two decades. It starts to become, basically, it won't be a choice. Other things will have to happen. So we're passing that decision and level of choice onto the next generation, who are obviously coming out as more unhappy at the inaction. So being involved in conservation work for decades and knowing that, you know, they managed to get a consensus in 1992 about the importance of this. That was the Rio Earth Summit. That kicked off all the climate change stuff, all the biodiversity crisis stuff, and it's still after decades, you know, fact after fact after fact is coming out. But that doesn't mean to say we're not having wins within that. You know, we know what's successful often, and we know where to influence in terms of policy and on our actions and things. So we can do that, you know, and that's not all being negative. You know, we know nature-friendly farming networks and things, you know, that can all be done right if we get the right steps in place.
You're listening to Perspective on Manx Radio. Before we wrap up discussion for this afternoon, it's time now for a slightly different angle on the island's ecosystem. Earlier this week, Aaron Ibanez spoke to Dr. Peter Duncan, who is the Senior Marine Environment Officer at DEFA. Aaron began by asking him what the major threats are facing our oceans today.
There's a whole range of threats from the large scale things like climate change, where you've got increasing sea surface temperature, increasing sea temperature. And the effect of carbon dioxide in the environment, it actually dissolves in water, in seawater. And the effect of that is that it tends to change the acidification of seawater. So ocean acidification is a global problem. And animals, plants, etc., are adapted to tolerate particular temperatures, particular acidification levels, etc. And if that changes significantly or quickly, then those species can become under stress and start to disappear or be vulnerable to disease, etc. So those are the big scale things. And if you look closer, then a lot of the activities that we undertake in the marine environment, whether that's transport, whether that even recreation, but things like commercial fishing, for example, extraction of oil and gas, extraction of aggregates, gravels, sands, can all have an impact on the environment if those processes are not looked after carefully and go through an assessment process and work out what the potential dangers are and then we mitigate the risks associated with them.
There's a growing consensus now amongst environmentalists, I suppose scientists in both the field of ecology and marine life as well, that there is an ecological crisis facing the planet, amongst what's being coined as a bit of as a climate breakdown as well. How difficult is it to monitor the situation under the water? Because, of course, on land it's far more accessible.
Definitely. And to be honest, that's always been the problem with the marine environment. It's difficult to see under it, and it's difficult to monitor it. It's expensive to monitor it. And so what we've found over the years is that there are long-term monitoring programs, and the Alaman government as it undertakes marine environmental monitoring, whether it's sea surface temperature or phytoplankton in the water or the general characteristics of water quality. And that can lead into things like bathing water quality as well. So we monitor the marine environment, but that it does take money. It does take a lot of effort to do that. When you're looking at larger scale events, then that needs to be coordinated over large scale, and those people taking the measurements need to talk to each other. But even things like biodiversity, I mean, that's a phrase or a term that's coined quite a lot. What it means is the abundance of different species that live in a place. But if it's all underwater, it's really difficult to see compared to land. It's difficult to know what's there, and it's difficult to know how many are there. And so monitoring biodiversity is quite a specialised, again, expensive activity to undertake. And some of the... So things we were talking earlier about Wildlife Week and raising awareness of what's there, then there are opportunities for people to get involved, particularly on the island, in citizen science, for want of a better word, getting involved in some of the organisations on the island, whether it's Manx Whale and Dolphin Watch, yeah. Manx Basking Shark Watch, and undertaking sort of volunteer work. Manx Wildlife Trust take on people to do volunteer work as well. So an awareness raising of it and actually contributing to monitoring what's out there certainly helps. I said to you earlier, there's an organisation on the island and around the UK called Sea Search, and they specifically monitor scientific or collect scientific data when they're on their recreational scuba diving. And they do it in a way which is standardised. So the data that they collect is really useful for governments to monitor changes in biodiversity, etc.
So this idea now of encouraging participation is really coming at quite a crucial time. And again, some environmentalists are referring to this as almost a tipping point in the natural balance of things.
It's always hard to know when tipping points are coming. But I think raising awareness of it is particularly important, and taking action before things do reach crisis points. And so I think things like the creation of marine nature reserves around the Isle of Man, for example, is one way that we can inbuilt a bit of security into the system. So those are now areas which are quite heavily protected. And so they become a little bit more resilient to change. If the quality of the environment is good, then organisms that live in it are much more resilient to changes in climate, changes in acidification, the threats from invasive alien species, for example. They can counter all of those threats a lot better than if they're under stress.
So these nature reserves are about 6 months old now, am I right in saying?
Yeah, they came into force in September of last year, and the evidence around the world is that over time that allows the environment to recover, and so biodiversity improves or increases. The animals, plants, algae, etc. become more resilient to changes. And the benefits that we see, whether it's from our experiences swimming underwater, swimming on top, kayaking, sailing, etc., and even fisheries benefit from improved environment, because those are the grounds from which a lot of the recruitment of juveniles produces, and you get effects like overspill from them into the rest of the area.
So the creation of these marine reserves came in light of purported threats, or in light of a need to allow our seas to recover? Was it, like, for example, was it a cure or a preventative sort of measure?
They've actually been the concept of marine protected areas started way back in 1989, would you believe, back in Port Erin Bay, when the Marine Lab was undertaking experiments and they really had to protect a particular area so that the experiments weren't interrupted. And I think over time, and that's really been an interesting characteristic of the island, is that as those marine protected areas have developed, in collaboration frequently with the fishing industry, they've actually seen the benefits. So they've seen the support for them grow because they've seen the benefits of them. So when we get into identification of particular habitats or species that need protection as well, then the two ideas of benefiting commercial exploitation and biodiversity and habitats and species sort of come together. So it's really been a 30-year journey to get to this point. But I think now that we're leading up to it, we integrate it into our planning. So we know that those exist, and that gives us resilience to the pressures of fishing, which we see a lot of in waters, not just around the Isle of Man, but elsewhere, that we have a certain built-in resilience to it. And so I wouldn't say that they've put in place as a quickly and as a result of immediate danger, but it's something that we believe underpins the marine environment, and therefore that underpins the kind of policy and philosophy and the management of what we want to achieve in the future.
When I imagine a marine reserve, perhaps from a human point of view on land, that's sort of recently been assigned a certain area. I imagine perhaps a grassy field that's been said, right, leave it alone, don't touch it. And that you mentioned there that perhaps, obviously this is taking place underwater, of course, but you mentioned there about the restoration. Is there any kind of active, I don't know, planting, so to speak? Because, you know, we're talking about restoration on land. Well, that's allowing forests to come back. So are we talking about underwater forests returning then?
I take the point, and the analogy is there, and it's always tempting to interfere in it. But we're used to managing land terrestrial environments and planting things and growing, etc. The difference, I think, with the marine environment is, if we think of it as the whole system is fluid, literally, and things move around it in ways that they don't on land. So actually, if you have the bare essentials there, then it becomes recolonized and it restores itself. And that's what I meant before about leaving nature to do that work itself. It does it best, it does it quickly and as efficiently as possible. When we get involved in artificial restoration, it ends up, unless it's really urgent or critical, you're generally better to leave it alone, because it's expensive, it's intensive, and it uses a lot of resources to do it. And it's not always successful. As I said, if you leave nature, its species and habitats to restore the ecosystem, it finds its own balance. The trick is not to let the environment degrade so much that you're really left with not much to reestablish. It's the difference between a partially forested woodland or something like that versus a brownfield site. You know, the things that start to grow on a brownfield site are basically your weeds and the really tolerant stuff. You're better off not getting to that point if you want to restore it to where it used to be.
That was Dr. Peter Duncan there speaking to Aaron Ibanez. That full interview will be available as a podcast at the conclusion of this programme. Before the break, we were talking a bit about some of the steps that can be taken to mitigate the ecological crisis, as it's been coined. Richard, if I could put you on the spot a bit here, how urgent is the situation we're facing?
I think to tackle that, we should think about what the changes are that we're seeing. And there's a few general things that we see in a lot of the data we see, whether it's birds or in insects. And that's that there's a decline of a lot of different species, often species that have maybe particular connections in the ecology. They're rare or threatened in some way, connected to particular habitats, but also very widespread species as well. And then they're being replaced by a much smaller number of highly adaptable versatile and sometimes mobile species. So you can see that in the bee world, you can see it in the bird world. So you lose corncrakes and turtle doves and you gain carrion crows and wood pigeons. So you get the species which can live very well in good numbers in very open and edge habitats that man provides on large scale in the modern world. And you lose a lot of species that are related to coastal habitats, to wetlands, to woodlands. So then how do you tackle those things? You've got a number of different issues that you're trying to deal with. Part of it, in terms of what the evidence is saying, is about the change of habitats towards urban development, different land uses in terms of food production, etc. The use of chemicals and the effects of that, and the challenge of how you incentivize a production of food with fewer inputs of inorganic fertilizers and pesticides, because we know those have an effect. We need that level of food production. We can't just, you know, do away with things. These things say, right, we're going to do everything organically, you know, across the world, and expect that not to have an effect. But we know that affects wildlife. So there's a challenge for technology and for our incentivized system, the politics of it, essentially, to think about in how we do things differently. And then you've got climate change, which is harder to change, but we have to think about what that means and how we adapt ourselves to those changes. So there's all that going on at the same time, and it is quite a big challenge to think our way through and say, right, what needs to happen on the ground and how do we resource that? And that's absolutely a political question.
In his interview with Laura McCoy, Aaron Ibanez spoke a bit about the man-made patchwork that we see on the landscapes today. Does the answer lie, or partly lie, in restoring what the island might once have looked like, or the world might once have looked like? Oh, Neil?
Going back is not necessarily the way forward, and there is a real danger that we get sentimental and we say, well, it used to be like this, that's how it should be. Actually, it should be as good as it can be for the conditions that are going to exist in the future. And we need to form a vision of what we think the island could look like at its best in 20, 40, 50, 100 years' time. And that is working with the conditions. And there's a really important point here, because some of the issues we've been discussing are issues that are really beyond the island's ability to actually solve, the big climate change issues. But it doesn't mean we can't show leadership in how our own society starts to do its little bit towards some of those issues. So I think the island has an opportunity to show leadership and to be exemplar by how it conducts itself. And that, I'm sure, will inspire other countries, other places, to take seriously climate change and to think that they too can make a bit of a contribution. But then there are things we can absolutely do here on our own home ground. And I'm sure the three of us here are all wholesome advocates for what a wonderful place the island is. And of course, the government strategy is that this is a great place to live and work. And of course it is, and we're here because of that. But we are destroying that proposition. And if you think that the way the land is broken down, we've got 88% under agriculture, about 5% is urbanised. So you've got 7% for everything else. And that indicates that if we're to have any success on the land at restoring nature to where we think it should be for the conditions we've got, then certainly the farming community has a large role to play in that, as do the rest of us.
The island, it's been very well documented, was recently accredited as having this UNESCO biosphere status. I think it's the first entire nation jurisdiction to be given that. That accreditation. Is there a risk that perhaps could encourage complacency about the environment we live in?
That's an interesting question.
Well, the answer is yes.
Yeah, so in effect, you know, is that a designation that means we've done all we need to do, or is it about the fact that action is needed? I'd very much be on the latter, because it's about recognition of everything that's been agreed internationally on biodiversity and climate change, sustainable development action. And you know, hopefully we'll see that kind of shift in philosophy as well. But the things we just talked about make for that kind of massive, substantial sell for what the biosphere is for the island, what we can sell internationally. You know, we just talked about it, we can easily decide to do this, what's necessary. You know, we kind of know how to make our sort of ecological networks and things better and bigger for wildlife, and where that starts to really start giving public benefits, you know, the knock-ons for nature tourism, all these things, how to work with farmers. We know that a lot of farmers do a lot of good for wildlife as well, and we can recognize that, and we can make sure that if there is shifts in action that are needed, that, you know, that's incentivized through the right policies. So we can decide to do all of this. It can definitely be positive. Does that require a kind of different scale of thinking and kind of investment? Perhaps. But if you took, some people don't like it, but if you took sort of thinking behind natural capital and kind of trying to value some of those wider benefits that we get from nature, that can get, you know, a little bit controversial in terms of, it's not meant to take away from the intrinsic value of nature or anything. But if you did measure that next to our usual reporting of GDP and the rest of it, you'd kind of start seeing where that started impacting on the balance sheet, which is an interesting way to communicate to politicians and decision makers. So that would be a very interesting thing if the actual health of our ecosystems were taken into account and balanced against that, and especially thinking long term into that future, then it warrants further investment. And that kind of value, we know that every year from an old study, it's sort of £42-43 million a year that it provides the economy, and that's thought of as conservative. So, you know, without even getting into updated figures, there's a rationale for investment, and the return is massive. We've talked about it. Not only is the future that we've got to think about, but yeah, the benefits of just thinking well about this and integrating it are huge to us in everyday life, whether we know it or not. You know, there's that importance there.
Neil, if I could come to you, when I asked about the biosphere and whether it kind of encouraged complacency, there was quite an emphatic yes. Can you tell us a bit about why that was your answer?
Yes, thank you. I have visited biospheres now in three different continents, and they are very different. And we have to remember that biosphere is really based on a human-centric view of the environment and the services that it provides to us. Biosphere status for the whole nation of the island, I think, is fantastic as an accreditation, but it's a starting point. And I think for the island, it should be a signal of intention. And I would fervently hope that at the end of the first 10 years of us being a biosphere, we can look back and say, within that 10 years, we have enhanced the island's nature, its wildlife and its ecology. And then for me, the biosphere project could be considered successful.
Just finally, we will of course hear from the DEFA minister about central policy making and the role the department plays next week on next week's program. But as an employee, Richard, I suppose your part of your role is to make some of these value judgments on a day by day, week by week basis, to try and preserve a better future for the island.
I certainly try to support the minister in trying to do the right thing for the people. On the biosphere side, I think it's fair to say the accreditation of the biosphere for the Isle of Man absolutely did recognise that there's something special about quality of life and what we have here, that's a value to look after for the future. But having said that, it's just as important to see it as not something that's in any way perfect or set in aspect, but a recognition of an intention to live and become more sustainable as an island. And therefore, it's as much a working towards as a saving what we've got. And so I hope that we can very much use the biosphere label that we've got in order to engender and embed a more sustainable outlook and continue to do better year on year. And so there's a lot of work that's done in terms of trying to engage people and raise awareness to that end. And so hopefully we'll see more and more of that, and people will feel good about the direction that we're headed in. And yeah, I hope that that will be seen as a very good thing across the community.
We are unfortunately running out of time, but thank you very much indeed to my guests, Tim Graham from the Manx Wildlife Trust, Neil Morris from Manx BirdLife, and Richard Selman from the Department of Environment, Food and Agriculture. Next week, we'll be joined by the DEFA Minister, Geoffrey Boot, and we're going to be talking about climate change in a perhaps a bit of a more political sense. Join us again next week. Take care.